We do need to get better at not just consuming aimlessly, of not just using these technologies for entertainment, of not just following the lead of apps and services that are designed to capture our attention. There's really a lot that needs to change in the educational systems to make sure that we understand what we're looking at and that we understand how information is created and how we can use the internet ourselves to change our societies and environments.
Hello and welcome to the community podcast by CoMatter, a series of conversations that explore how people connect, participate, and share in today's hyperspeed world. My name is Severin Matusek, this is episode 18, and my guest today is Solana Larsen. Solana is a journalist, editor, and activist currently leading the Internet Health Report at Mozilla in Berlin. The Internet Health Report asks important questions about the internet. Is it healthy? Is it safe? How open is it? And who is welcome? Mozilla publishes this report every year, and its third edition just got released today on April 24, 2019. So I took on the opportunity to ask Solana what she and her team found out this year. This is not about Instagram being down after all. It's about the state of an ecosystem that billions of people depend on for their lives and livelihood. Solana shares how internet health can be measured, why digital rights, digital literacy, and internet governance are important, and how each of us can contribute to improving the internet's well-being. Let me tell you this up front. Solana is both worried and optimistic about the future. Let's find out why. Here's episode 18 of the Community Podcast with Solana Larsen. Well, good morning, Solana.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I am well. I am super stressed because I'm still working on the final articles for the Internet Health Report, and we're about to publish in a little over a week. And every single piece of content is reviewed by multiple people, a lot of different people, experts on the topic, people who work at different parts of Mozilla. And so it's not just writing an article about something that happened. It's really a negotiation process with a whole bunch of people to figure out what makes sense to say and think and do on this topic right now.
Okay. And can you give us, what is the Internet Health Report overall? What's the quick pitch of why and how?
The Internet Health Report is a compilation of stories and data and analysis about the things that we could consider make the internet either healthier or less healthy. And it's a report that Mozilla publishes once a year that's made in collaboration with hundreds of people, actually, and where we try and take stock of where are we and where should we be going. And it's one time a year where we look at the internet in its entirety. You know, like when you read news about what's happening at different parts of the internet, there are a lot of articles about privacy issues, or there are a lot of articles about new tools or software or gadgets. And it's hard, I think, for a lot of people to think of the internet in its entirety as one big ecosystem where things are connected, and that the way things work in one end of the internet also affect how things work at the other end. And when we're thinking about things that affect our personal lives, like what our children have access to, or how we're targeted by ads, or whether we're under surveillance, depending on where we live in the world. And then we also think about what are the global ramifications, or what are the ramifications for my city or for my country. It just all gets very overwhelming. And so we try with the report to look at things across five different issues. It's a framework where we try and simplify. Look, these are the different things that you need to think about. You need to think about privacy. You need to think about openness. You need to think about control, who owns things, who decides how things work. And you also need to decide how people are able to, or how people should be able to learn about the things that affect their lives. And then when you look across all these issues and you think about, okay, here are a bunch of things that are going wrong, but here are also really a lot of things that are getting better. And individuals, people, and projects who are working to make things better and actually having results. And I think that's one thing that's often missing when we think about the internet, is thinking about the things that you really can make a difference on, and celebrating the people and the initiatives that are really having an effect. Because it's not all just going downhill. There are a lot of things that are working extremely well and that we just take for granted.
Mm-hmm. So when you first came up with the Internet Health Report, how hard was it to find these five different categories? Because as you said, I think the internet today is such a vast network. It's kind of like the sky above our heads, you know, with millions of satellites and stars and all of this. Like, it's so all-encompassing that I could imagine it's super hard to come up with these categories, and also to say, how do these categories really define health? Like, health is such a word that says, you know, how are you doing? Are you healthy or are you not healthy? So how did you come up with it?
So I think coming up with these five topics has been a bit of a negotiation process, again, between different people and priorities. I don't think these five issues are perfect by any means. There are some topics where you could either put them in several different categories or where they don't fit in at all, I think. Try not to be too rigid about these issues, I think, but they're helpful in terms of not losing sight of the things that matter. Like, I think unless you have these categories, you can too easily just get pulled into thinking about privacy and security issues all the time. Mm. And then you lose sight, I think, of all the things that people are learning and doing to use the internet in different ways, or the way that we're advancing knowledge and understanding of how to bring new populations online. Like, they're just, I think the five issues that we have are an expression of what we feel the priorities should be in terms of how to think about making the internet healthier. And this concept of internet health is like an umbrella term that goes over. And it's like you say, like, what does it mean for something to be healthy? What does it mean for a person to be healthy? It's a very kind of fluid expression that's open to interpretation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's no such thing in the human realm. There's no such thing as perfect human health. It's not like now you're healthy and you never have to exercise or eat healthy again. Mm. It's a constant process of maintenance and assessment. And, you know, there is no perfection in sight. And I think the same is true of the internet. There is no such thing as a perfectly healthy internet, because it reflects human life and society and all our imperfections of governance and business. And so we can strive to have a healthier internet, and we can strive to have a healthier relationship to the internet. And that's what this is about, is about thinking about it in these kind of holistic terms. Mm. And less than human health, thinking about it more as a healthy ecosystem, where you're thinking about balance. And an ecosystem is also not, you know, like the rainforest is never, you know, immune to influences that are in the atmosphere and all over the world. But what can you do to make these ecosystems healthier and you know, appreciate how they adapt to things that are happening on the planet?
Yeah. And maybe before we jump into the details of the 2019 health report, I'm also really curious about your personal background and story. So what is your personal relationship to the internet? When was the first time you entered the internet, and how did it impact your life until now?
I guess I started with internet when it was still a dial-up connection and a modem. My family was, my whole family were early adopters of the internet, and especially my father. And the first time I used it was for a high school assignment. And it was in Usenet forums at that point, and I was asking about global reactions to a book that had been written about Denmark. Mm-hmm. And I got dozens of responses from different parts of the world, and it was really this exciting window on perspectives from people all around the world. And as I went into journalism when I grew older and went to university, I think I always was very focused on the internet as a way of thinking about communication and politics and how you could change the media and how you could change how democracy works. So I think I was probably on the extremely optimistic and curious side of trying to think about how we could use the internet for global understanding. I'm half Danish and half Puerto Rican, and one of the first projects I worked on after I graduated from journalism school in London was a website called Open Democracy that still exists today. And at the time, it was just one of the first serious publications for global analysis that involved people from all over the world. And a lot of times we were reaching out to famous writers, famous professors, and asking them to publish something on the internet. And for many, it was the first time they had anything published on the internet at all. A lot of newspapers were still not fully online. And we were just beginning to explore what it would mean to discuss these topics of global importance, like, you know, the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq, or the ramifications of 9/11, or any number of topics that were really, it felt urgent to discuss from more perspectives than you would get from traditional mainstream media, especially in the Anglophone world. So later I started working with Global Voices, which is also a website that still exists today. I was the editor for several years of this global community, mostly run by volunteers, where we covered international news through the words of bloggers, mm-hmm. and digital activists around the world, and especially in Latin America, Africa, Middle East, Asia, basically outside North America and Europe, tried to supplement really what was being reported in international media, or in some cases, you know, we were the only ones talking about what was happening in Madagascar or any number of countries or crises. And at that point, the international media hadn't quite figured out how to use social media and the internet. Mm-hmm. And so we had early partnerships with Reuters, with BBC, with many big news organizations who were still trying to figure out what their attitude to the internet should be and trying to figure out how they should be using it. Mm-hmm. as a source and as a medium for reporting. So that's how I started on all these topics. Mm-hmm. And later, around the time that I left Global Voices some years ago, I was feeling very depressed really about the internet. I mean, around the time that the Snowden revelations happened, and after some time after the Arab Spring, when people were really disappointed, a lot of the people who I knew either personally or just from reading their writing on Global Voices were jailed. There was a lot of violence directed towards people who had been working in the internet sphere, and just a real sense of gloom about everything we had been so optimistic about. And when Mozilla approached me about working on this report, I was in a moment of kind of soul searching and trying to figure out what is there still to be optimistic about in this internet situation. And for me, it's not only just about internet. Like, no, the internet on its own, in isolation of everything that you could use it for to improve human society, is not interesting. Like, it regaining some hope and optimism about the problems that we're facing being something that we can turn around is something that I think been able to recover a bit in working with Mozilla. And the reason is, this is in large part a community of technologists, and they have an entirely different attitude to what it means to fix a problem, especially a technological problem, than a lot of the people in the activism and media world have. They have a kind of institutional memory of how the internet was created and are closer to the decisions that are taken that decide how things work. And so it just seems, I think a lot of the time before, I felt like Google and Facebook and these were like mythical organizations that were very far away from me and very difficult to approach. Mm. And suddenly I feel like, you know, it's like Emperor's New Clothes or something, you know, that they're just they're just companies like any other. Yes, they're really big and powerful, and but it just seems a little more approachable and close by when you're working with people who are so close to the technology that's being developed. And so bringing together these worlds of media and activism and technology and policy is something that's really exciting to be at the center of. And the Internet Health Report is a publication where we try and convene a lot of these different perspectives and try and break the silos between these communities and have an open and frank conversation about what is possible. And, you know, it's just a publication. It's about 40, 50 articles. We'll see how many make it to publication. But around then, about actually vastly different topics. But when you look at all of them, there's a common theme about, you know, trying to look at the kind of invisible structural factors behind things and try and understand how did this come to be? How can we make it better? And for me, at least, I don't know for everybody who reads it, for me, at least, it gives me a sense of optimism and a sense that we have, you know, as humanity, some agency about figuring out what should happen.
Mm-hmm. But so maybe can you also dive a bit deeper into what Mozilla is and the role of Mozilla maybe in this whole internet ecosystem? Because I understand probably a lot of our listeners, you know about Mozilla as the creators of the Firefox browser, right? Mm-hmm. But I know there's also Mozilla Foundation, and I know Mozilla does a lot of things actually about activism and internet and policies. So how is Mozilla as a company different than a Google or a Facebook or other technology providers that people use on a daily basis?
Mm-hmm. The vast majority of people at Mozilla work on Firefox. And mm-hmm. Firefox is used by around 300 million people around the world. It is a browser with a significant market share on desktop. Maybe, I think it's just under 20% on desktop computers. It used to be higher, mm-hmm. But Chrome is eating everything. Google, the Google machine is quickly, you know, gaining power. And where Google has Chrome, but they use Chrome to advance their other interests. You know, they use it to sell ads. They use it to gain information about you. They have all these other products. And the browser is, you know, a way to help them in their other business interests. Safari is a product of Apple, but Apple's main interest is to sell phones. You know, so again, like the browser for them is a way to make money on something really entirely different. Yeah. The goal of Mozilla is just to let you browse better.
Yeah.
You know, there isn't any kind of hidden agenda or profit motive. It's a nonprofit. And the whole concept and philosophy of the whole project was to create an alternative, to make sure that there's a non-commercial alternative that puts users at the forefront of decisions. And then now, you know, the way that we're talking about this message is internet health, but it's really wrapped up in all these different issues that I'm talking about. You know, how can you make it a better experience? How can you make sure that the internet is something that is positive? And so the money that Mozilla is able to get through Firefox, a large part of it is put into things that the foundation is doing. We also get a lot of donations from people around the world. And what we do these days is, in large part, we have a lot of fellowships, people who work on internet research around the world, people who work on internet activism. We've been involved in digital literacy projects all over the world. Lots of activities around open source programming and diversity in open source programming, and involving women, involving people from different parts of the world, working with students, young people, really a pretty vast amount of topics. And there is also a small policy team, partly works in Europe, mm-hmm. in Brussels, trying to advance policies that are good for the internet and good for people who use the internet, and are kind of a voice of reason, I think, against, much, much, much bigger companies who have much greater lobbying powers. And so being able to use this our position in the market as a serious technology provider, but at the same time with civil society and nonprofit sensibilities, I think is where Mozilla is exciting as an agent of change. We also have advocacy campaigns like petitions and those kinds of things where we push for specific changes. We just had a campaign yesterday where we were asking, Apple did a whole bunch of ads on how great they are for privacy, mm-hmm. and Mozilla just did a petition saying, oh, well, if you're so great for privacy, why don't you change how the ad identifiers work on iPhones? Mm. Why don't you reset the ad identifier every single month instead of leaving it to users to do themselves? Another campaign was about Internet of Things, IoT, internet-connected toys that are really insecure. And we called on Walmart and Amazon and other online retailers to take these things off the market when they were proven to have security flaws. And a lot of times, because you're a big company and because you have a lot of users and a big mailing list, you can push for change in ways that it can be harder to do if you're small. So it's an advocacy and policy and, a strange mix of different interests, but what keeps it all together is really the fact that we have this technology. But when we're thinking about what happens after the browser, if mm-hmm. we're all moving on to voice computing or virtual reality, or Mozilla is also working behind the scenes often to make sure that new technological developments are also happening in ways that aren't just dominated by the big companies. So with virtual reality, for instance, a lot of the big companies would love if they would have the headset, if they had control of both the headset and the technology, so you could only view their VR on their headset, these kind of closed yeah. environments for technical development, yeah. where Mozilla has said, no, let's have something called web VR. Let's make sure that we have this interoperability between platforms, working on standards so that things can show up on the web no matter what platform. Like these kinds of decisions that get made behind the scenes about how the web works, about how the app ecosystem works, Mozilla is an influential voice here. And that's from, the engineers all the way up to people who work more on the nonprofit or media side of things.
Cool. So talking about the 2019 Internet Health Report, you mentioned there's about 50 articles. You're not sure of how many will get published in the end, but also that your personal history with the report is that you started the report, working on the report at a time when you were a little bit unsure about the future of the internet or like how positive it actually is. So talking about your findings in 2019, what is it that gives you hope? And what is it that you're worried about from what you found out about the health of the internet today?
Well, this is the third version of the health report that's coming out. We did a prototype in 2017, a full version 2018, and now 2019 is the second full version that we're doing. And so a lot of the issues repeat in a way. The big companies are still in control of way too much, I think, and have way too unfair an advantage. But there are also things that are moving forward. Like I think in the world of regulation, for instance, there have been some really significant experiments, attempts to codify what it means for privacy to exist in the digital realm. I mean, of course, there's things like the GDPR in Europe, which is held up as an example. But there are a lot of other attempts, I think, to figure out how responsible should the companies be, how responsible should the governments be, in the realm of internet governance, too. When I think about, we've been at different stages with the internet of either wanting the governments entirely out or in other parts of the world wanting the governments to take over everything, and like finding this balance between what should the companies rule, what should the governments rule, and what role should civil society play? I think we're moving towards a better understanding of how these different things have to work in concert with each other in order for good things to happen or better things to happen. You know, fines for big companies and the even the debates that have happened with Mark Zuckerberg and the U.S. Congress, like there we are at a different stage of interrogating the way that things work today. So that's a positive. I mean, it's always a little bit like, is the glass half full or half empty, right?
Yeah.
Because there have also been great strides, I think, in some privacy and security tools and techniques or ways that the internet works. But of course, they're also in reaction to really terrible things that have happened on the internet or using the internet. So it's always this push and pull. New threats are showing up rapidly. And I think AI, artificial intelligence, is one area where all the risks that we're used to suddenly seem much greater. You know, it's like all the regular risks of the internet on steroids, because the scale of what we're trying to do with technology and with network computing is so much bigger than what it used to be. And the ramifications also for different populations around the world. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot that is really terrifying, but we know a lot better as a global community what some of the things are that need to happen to improve things. Whether there's political will or will from the companies, you know, that remains to be seen. But I think we know a lot more about what needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, you know, when you mentioned technologies like AI and the involvement of governments and so on, In the large majority, or like if you look at the internet at large, we're still talking about a very, very small percentage of people and players that actually build these technologies and build new platforms. And 99.9% of internet users are actually users and consumers. Do you think that we as consumers or we as citizens who use the internet, should we be more educated about what the internet can do for us? Because I feel like a lot of people nowadays mostly consume content, and the internet for a lot of people have become like a huge entertainment machine, whereas it has so many other possibilities. Do you think we know enough, and how can we change that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's also when you look at these global statistics about how many more people are coming online around the world, you rarely get the question, okay, but what are people doing?
Yeah.
What does it mean when is it meaningful to be online? Is it meaningful if you're just using Facebook and WhatsApp? I think it's meaningful when you're able to use it for research. It's meaningful when you're able to use it for education in school, or to better take care of your children's health. Or, you know, there are ways where we forget how the internet makes our lives better because we're used to it in this part of the world. We're used to just being able to pull up a Google map and know exactly where we're going, and to know what's happening in our country. And you know, there's all kinds of transparency and ease that we just take for granted now. But yeah, I think we do need to get better at not just consuming aimlessly, of not just using these technologies for entertainment, of not just, you know, following the lead of apps and services that are designed to capture our attention and, you know, possibly addict us to their systems. The crisis over disinformation around the world, and the way that people are increasingly worried about the risks to public health and the risk to democracy and electoral, you know, credibility. This is all, I think, tied in with how digitally literate we are. And that is from, you know, the wealthiest parts of the world to the poorest parts of the world. Those are things that I think we share in common across humanity. And there is really a lot that needs to change in the educational systems to make sure that we understand what we're looking at and that we understand how information is created and how we can use the internet ourselves to change our societies and environments. And I think, you know, when you also look at startup culture and what people are thinking about in terms of, like, if you wanted to make a new service or app, are you thinking about how to make the next $1 million business or how to raise, you know, the hundreds of thousands of dollars of venture capital funding? Or are you thinking about how you could use the internet to, you know, improve society? Are you thinking about how you could be using AI to do something good for the world? And that's where I think there's a bit of a mismatch, where the internet has been so commercialized in so many different ways that we... What does it mean? What is the equivalent of like public service broadcast for the internet? What is a public service internet? And what responsibility do civic institutions, organizations, public institutions, organizations, like, what is their responsibility on the internet? And how should they be involved in innovation and development also of advanced technologies? How do we fund that? How do we create that mentality that should even be something that they're thinking about, and that we at home are thinking about? Those are things, I think, that where there's really a lot of scope for change, and probably, you know, as some things might get worse with AI or with other technologies where the risks haven't been properly assessed, many times solutions will need to be developed that also use technology. It's one of the things that makes it so difficult to assess these topics, is that enemy and your friend is the same all the time. Like, the governments are our enemy when they censor or when they shut down the internet or when they survey, but they're your friend when they regulate in ways that are, you know, good for innovation and for competition and for the privacy of individuals. And the same with the big technology companies. They've enabled us to do the most incredible things and put extremely powerful technology in the hands of so many people, but they've also abused our trust in some ways and have found ways to profit on practices that are not healthy for society, we see. And so the same with technology. Sometimes it's our friend, and sometimes we need to rein it in a little bit.
Are there any platforms that you think are gonna be big in the next few years? Any platforms or any services or any websites where, like, or any apps where you, hey, they are actually approaching things differently? This could really result in a different way of interacting with each other or a different way of sharing information. Is there anything you see out there that you're currently excited about?
There's a lot. I think voice-controlled technology is really interesting, and not just from the perspective of, oh, this is cool, we can talk to computers without looking at them or touching them, but more, it's an area that could be used for much more social good, you know, for diversity, for inclusion. Depending on how your attitude to these technologies is, you could do a lot of things. Mozilla has one project that is about people in different languages donating their voices. It's called Common Voice, and you can donate your voice. You read some text aloud, or you can review what somebody else has recorded, and contribute to creating an open source database of voices that are used for machine learning, so that computers can understand not just the languages that make sense from a market and commercial perspective, but also minority languages, languages of small populations, and that it can be used by anybody for any purpose. And so people who are innovating technologies, maybe not with commercial interests in mind, for accessibility, for diversity, they will have access to resource that they can use, you know. Like that, I think that's part of the creativity that is made possible when you try and think about how can you advance these things in a way that would be better for humanity. Different business models for the internet. Really interesting stream of thought right now is around platform cooperatives. How do you create internet businesses where the users are co-owners of the business? Like if you imagine, you know, what if all the people who use Facebook were co-owners and you could have a more democratic way of deciding how they should work and what should happen. A lot of smaller companies are trying to break the cycle of VC funding and all of the culture that comes with that and try and think of different ways to fund small-scale projects in the public interest. I find that really exciting as an experimentational field. To give an example, there's one woman who's created this this project where it's for medical research, and she's made a community of people who have a rare medical condition, and they've given their data, and they rent their data to the pharmaceutical industry, mm-hmm. and then share both the profits and the control over what happens to their data. Normally, if you give that kind of data to a pharmaceutical company, you will never see any piece of the profit or any kind of power in terms of decision making of which way the research should go or what should happen. And so using the internet and the tools that we have for these kinds of distributed collaborations, really, there's a lot of scope for doing things even on a really large scale once you start thinking about what would you like to do differently. So I think there are lots of things. We just have to see what will scale up.
Yeah.
Make sure that some of these things have a real impact on people's lives.
So maybe as a final question, let's move 1 week ahead in a little time capsule, and it's April 23 today, and the Internet Health Report has just been published.
April 24.
April 24. Okay, it's April 24 today. It's a beautiful day. What can I do now? Should I read the Internet Health Report? Can I interact with it in some way? Can I share it? What do we want listeners to this podcast to do with the Internet Health Report?
I would love... Now, it's called a report, but it's really not... I guess I should have said that earlier, but it's really not like this heavy academic thing. It's mm-hmm. a very light and accessible read. So every topic that's described is described in not so many words and in a way that's really easy to understand.
It's not optimized for the internet.
Yeah, it's not meant to be boring. And I think because it's such a wide range of topics, I mean, I would never expect everybody to know everything. It's also not meant to be read from one end to the other. I mean, I know some people do that, but it's a thing that's meant to be browsed. And you can look at the headlines and see what kind of topics interest you. And you can dip in and out of different topics. And this year, to make that even more clear, we've given people the ability to make their own reading lists on the website. And you can choose things that you would like to read later or create a reading list that you can share with other people. So I would love if people created reading lists and shared the articles that they care about. For me, there are 4 or 5, 6 articles that have really changed my perspective on things right now. And those will be the ones that I'll be most eager to share. I think everybody has a different perspective of what it will be for them. And that's the kind of conversation that I'd love for us to have, you know, to zoom out and think about the internet in its entirety and maybe shift our perspective on what we can do in our own work to make things better. We have 3 spotlight articles this year that are kind of the central arguments, I guess, of the year. We're looking at artificial intelligence. We're looking at the ad ecosystem, you know, thinking about what could be done different. And then finally, the power of cities in different parts of the world that are working to make the internet healthier and using their power and also their collective power to change things in ways that national governments sometimes aren't able to do or unwilling to do.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, thank you so much for the interview, Solana. This was very insightful.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much, Solana, for such an interesting conversation and for creating the Internet Health Report together with your team and a global community of contributors. It's out now at internethealthreport.org. That's one word for you to read. This is the community podcast by CoMatter. Thank you for listening. I'm Severin. This was Solana. And if you're interested in more conversations like this, please hit subscribe in your app or wherever you listen to this podcast to hear about our next episodes. We usually publish a new episode every 2 weeks, and previous guests you might be interested in are Harper Reed, the guy who pioneered crowdsourcing in the early Web 2.0 days and became the CTO of Barack Obama's presidential campaign and has a lot of interesting stuff to tell, or Claire L. Evans, who wrote a fascinating book about the women who made the internet and talks to me about that in a previous episode. To listen to it, just search for the community podcast by CoMatter in your app, or just CoMatter, that's co-matter, and have a listen. You can also find more stories about people, the internet, and everything that's in between at comatter.com, a platform that explores what makes communities thrive. Thank you so much. Have a great day.